behind him on the bed, pressed against Kip's back, joined by a glue of sweat and semen. His cock is lodged deep in the boy's ass, holding him impaled like a fish on a hook. He nuzzles the back of Kip's neck, grazing it with his lips, nipping gently with his teeth. They are alone, and the room is dark and quiet, except for the low mewling sounds that Kip occasionally makes, like a puppy whimpering in its sleep. Leo has come and gone. Come twice. Once in Kip's ass, once in his mouth. Kip's mind is neither awake nor asleep, but motionless, running in place. The eternity of the past few hours replays itself over and over in his head. Leo's huge, gnarled cock in his mouth, the wire hanger slashing out of nowhere against his already punished ass. The memory makes him flinch, and the vibrations of Kip's muffled scream coursing through the man's dick, making it tingle. Leo liked the effect. Vince obliged, wielding the hanger with a strong right arm. They traded places. Leo whipped even harder than Vince. Then they moved on to another game. Leo seldom fucked ass, at least not boy ass. That's what he said. But Kip was the exception. Vince and Leo double-dicked him like seasoned partners, one of them screwing his mouth, the other his rear, pulling out to trade places again and again until Kip hardly knew which man fucked him and which man he sucked. His body was a long, continuous tube, plugged with thick cock at both ends. Eventually, they untied him. Leo said something about getting his gun to make sure the kid didn't bolt. The words hardly registered on Kip's exhausted brain, but Vince snapped at Leo to shut up. "You're gonna really fuck us up one of these days, Battaglia. You're always too fucking careless with your mouth." But his anger cooled quickly as they returned to using Kip. To satisfy Leo, he retied Kip's hands behind his back. They put him on his knees, then took their places at opposite ends of the room and made him crawl stupefied from cock to cock. When one of them had finished with him for the moment, he would shove the boy away, and Kip would shuffle awkwardly to the other, scraping his knees against the carpet until they were raw. Depending on the hold preferred, he would bow his head to suck, or else turn around and stagger to his feet, squatting back to take the waiting cock up his ass, while the man across the room watched and pulled on his own freshly serviced dick. When Kip suddenly came to a standstill in the middle of the room, unable to go on and begging them to let him rest, Vince reached for the hanger. Kip continued to crawl miles and miles without ever leaving the room. At some point, hazy in Kip's memory, Leo finally left, returning to his own room, leaving the taste of his oily semen warm and fresh on Kip's tongue. Then the evening wound down and contracted to a single spot, concentrated at the point where Vince's cock is now snugly lodged inside the boy's well-worked hole. The cock is deeply rooted, almost motionless, but Kip's ass is so tender that the least movement sends twinges of sensation through his crammed bowels. He can feel each beat of Vince's heart from the veins that throb against his rectal walls. Vince plays his passive body like an instrument, making him whimper and squirm. His caresses are slow, calculated, tender. But Kip's raw flesh is so acutely tuned that even the most delicate touch courses through him like the crack of a whip. Vince runs his fingertips over Kip's nipples, down the ridges of his belly. The boy quivers in response. He squeezes the swollen head of Kip's cock gently and strokes the shaft once with his forefinger and thumb. Kip shudders, on the verge of coming. Vince flicks his finger against the boy's balls, seizes a hair, and slowly, slowly, plucks it. Kip's rectum convulses around the man's cock. Vince runs his hand over the boy's hip, onto his ass, and plays his fingertips across the welts, like a blind man reading Braille. His other hand, circling Kip from below, finds a nipple to twist gently. Kip writhes in the man's embrace and squeezes his ass around the big, inexhaustible cock with a slow, steady rhythm. For Vince, this is the best of all fucks. The final screw. A tenderized hole that throbs around his dick. A boy who quivers like a bowstring in his arms at the least whisper of a touch. It has taken all night to bring Kip to this point. The effort is always worth it. A pale blue light shows through the heavy drapes. Dawn, and soon Vince will have to end it. Kip is the best he's had in months. He could easily spend a week working the kid over, or a month, grinding him harder and harder beneath his heel, seeing just how deep the boy's hunger dwells. But Vince has an early morning flight to catch, and now that the job is done, there is no reason to stay and every reason to leave. Soon he will come in the boy's ass for the final time. And then, to milk the last few drops from his cock, he will finally bring Kip off. The boy's cock is primed to bursting, and has been for hours. A single stroke will do it. A glide of his fingernail down the underbelly of Kip's cock, and the stubby little erection will give a twitch and suddenly explode. And then Vince hears a noise. In the hallway, muffled steps, someone walking up the hall. Not someone. The noise is too complicated to come from a lone walker, or even two. A group of people coming up the hall. Vince goes rigid, wide awake. A sound at the door. Not the normal jangling of a key in a lock, but quiet, methodical, a stalking covert sound. He is off the bed in an instant. He takes Kip with him, keeping his cock in the boy's ass as he bolts toward the dresser and fumbles in the open briefcase for his gun. Kip squeals in protest. The swirling movement dizzies him. The sudden jogging of the cock in his ass threatens to send him over the edge. The gun flashes in the corner of his eye, and he stiffens in fear, groggy and confused, but coming rapidly to his senses. The door to the room bursts open, ripping the chain lock from the wall. Almost instantly, the overhead light flashes on, blinding after the darkness as they rush into the room. A man in plain clothes, and behind him uniformed police, at least five of them, more in the hallway, all holding guns. There is a frozen moment of shock on all sides. Vince's arm is locked across Kip's chest. His cock is still in the boy's ass, throbbing with a jackrabbit pulse. He holds the gun to Kip's throat. "My, my," the plainclothesman finally speaks. The room seethes with tension, but the man sounds bored, covering his agitation with studied finesse. He shakes his head. "We knew you was a killer, Zoriel, but I had no idea." Kip's whole body prickles with heat. He cannot escape. There is no way to hide. He feels the eyes of all the men rake over his naked body, hoisted to tiptoes on Vince's cock. He hears them murmur in shock and derision. Pussy boy, caught in the act. His cock juts stiffly from his hips for all to see, quivering and closer than ever to coming. The plainclothesman speaks slowly, deliberately, getting down to business. "Come on, Zario. There's no way out of this hole. We got half the department down in the lobby, and the rest are taking a coffee break across the street. Come on, you don't want to hurt the kid." Vince stands stock still, breathing hard. His heartbeat pounds like a fist against Kip's back. And then it happens. Kip cannot stop it. He tries desperately to cover himself with his hands, but his arms are pinned to his sides. His cock twitches and bobs in the air, and then begins to shoot. Long, spiraling ribbons of stored-up semen that jet halfway across the room, landing with a dull splat on the carpet before the plainclothesman's feet. He writhes helplessly in Vince's hold, jerking weirdly like a puppet. The ordeal seems to go on forever. The officers stare speechless. One of them mutters, "Holy shit!" Behind Vince, the door to Battaglia's room bursts open. Vince whirls halfway round, a confusion of sudden movement and shouting, "Watch out!" Then the deafening blast of pistol fire, three times in rapid succession. With each shot, Vince convulses in a horrible parody of fucking Kip's ass. He staggers forward, his weight bowing Kip's shoulders, then falls back. His softening cock pulls out of Kip's bowels with a loud, liquid fart. His body slams the floor with a thud that reverberates into the soles of Kip's feet. Kip swings around, his cock still twitching and dribbling. For an instant, he sees the motionless hulk of Vince's body lying flat on his back with a strange, surly grimace on his face, his eyes wide open. Then the cops are everywhere. A swirling sea of blue, and the plainclothesman is on him, grabbing Kip by the shoulders and steering him toward the door to Batalia's room.
"No," Kip whispers dully, looking over his shoulder. "No."
There are more cops in the other room, and Leo, standing handcuffed in his purple robe, his big, ugly face made even uglier by the unexpected tears gushing over his rumpled jowls. The cops, flushed with triumph, are startled at the sight of Kip, then rally with whistles and jeers. "Can it," the plainclothesman says. He yanks the spread from Leo's bed and wraps it over Kip's shoulders. With the bedspread folded around him, Kip stands mute and numb as a refugee, shivering uncontrollably. The plainclothesman speaks softly, asking him something, but Kip does not hear. He turns and stares into the other room. Through the narrow frame of the doorway, he can see only Vince's legs and feet. Then a blanket descends, and only the feet are visible. And then, as the policemen swarm, even the feet are lost to sight, obscured by a maze of blue trousers and shiny black boots.
An excerpt from Citra et Trans by Samuel Delaney, from Best American Erotica, 1993. Read by Stefan Rudnicki.
"I may be bringing someone home with me," Turkish John said. "A man, I mean." John had a long nose. "You won't mind, will you? We'll use the bed in the kitchen. I promise we won't bother you. But..." John's blonde hair was half gray. His skin was faintly wrinkled and very dry. "It probably isn't a good idea to mention it to Delise." "I won't," I said. "I promise. By the time she's back, I'll be gone anyway." "I meant in a letter or something." "But believe me," he said, "I only pick up nice men, or boys. There won't be any trouble." And later, on the cot bed in the front room of the tiny two-room Anafiotika house, set in the mountain behind the Acropolis, I went to sleep. In Stamboul, just off Istiklal, John had had a sumptuous third-floor apartment full of copper coffee tables, towering plants, rich rugs and hangings. When I'd been staying at the youth hostel, one afternoon he'd fed me a wonderful high tea at his place that had kept me going for 2 days. A pocket full of leftovers and a cloth napkin had an hour later even made lunch for towering, timid Jerry. I woke up to whispered Greek, the lock, and two more Greek voices. One laughed as though he were coughing. Shushing them, John herded two sailors in their whites through the rooms. The squat one halted in the door to the kitchen, in which was Delise's bed that John used to paw the hanging back. He had a beer bottle in one hand. He laughed hoarsely once more. Then the tall one, towering him by almost two heads, shoved past, with John right after. I turned over, then turned back. Frowning, I reached down and pulled my wallet out of the pocket of my jeans where I dropped them over the neck of my guitar case sticking from under the bed. It was also my suitcase. I sat, slipped the wallet behind the books on the shelf beside me. Then I lay back down. John came back through the hanging. All he wore now was a blue shirt with yellow flowers. He squatted beside me, knees jackknifed up, to whisper, "There's two of them, I'm afraid. So if you wanted to entertain one, just to keep him busy while I did the other one, really, I wouldn't mind. Actually, it would be a sort of favor." "I'm sorry, John," I said. Thanks, but I'm awfully tired.
All right.
He patted my forearm, where it was bent under my cheek. He smelled drunk. But you can't say I didn't ask. And I certainly don't mind sharing, if you change your mind. Then he said, I haven't spoken Demotiki with anyone in more than a year. I'm surprised I'm doing as well as I am. Chuckling, he was up and back into the kitchen, thin buttocks grinding below blue and yellow shirt tails. He disappeared around the hanging into the lighted kitchen. Greek and laughter. I drifted off, despite the noise. Something bumped my arm. I opened my eyes. The little lamp in the corner was on. The squat sailor stood by my bed, leg pressed against my arm. Looking down at me, with one hand he joggled his crotch. Then he said questioningly, "Pusti, pusti?" I looked up. "Huh? Pusti, pusti?" He rubbed with broad, gypsy dark fingers. A gold ring hugged deep into the middle one's flesh. Pointing at my face with his other hand, he began to thumb open the buttons around his lap flap. Once he reached over to squeeze my backside. Hard, too. "Ah, hey," I pushed. "No, no." I made dismissive gestures. "I don't want to. The ten telo. Fevge, fevge. I don't want to. Go away, go away." "Nay." Then he repeated, "Pusti, pusti," emphatically. The flap fell from black groin hair that, I swear, went halfway up his belly. His penis swung up, two-thirds the length of mine, half again as thick. His nails were worn short from labor, and you could tell his palms and the insides of his fingers were rock rough. "Hey, come on." I pulled back and tried to sit up. "Cut it out, will you? The tentelo. Nakanome parea. I don't want to mess around with you." But he grabbed the back of my head to pull my face at his groin, hard enough to hurt my neck. For a moment, I figured maybe I should go along so he wouldn't hurt me more. I opened my mouth to take him, and he pushed in hard. I tasted the bitter sharpness of the cologne he doused himself with. And cologne on a dick is my least favorite taste in the world. Under it was the sweat of someone who'd been drinking steadily at least 2 days. While he clawed into the back of my neck, I thought, this is stupid. I tried to pry my head from under his hand and push him out with my tongue, and thought I'd done it, but he'd just moved, fast, across the bed on one knee. It was a hot night. I hadn't been sleeping with any covers. He grabbed my underpants and, when I tried to dodge away, ripped them down my legs. "Hey!" I squirmed around trying to pull them back up. But he pushed me, hard, down on the bed. With one knee on my buttock and leaning full on my shoulders, he shouted into the other room, while I managed to lift myself and him up first on one elbow, then on the other. I was about to try and twist him off, so I didn't see the tall one come through, but suddenly he loomed, to grab my arms and yank both by my wrists forward. I went off my elbows and down. The sailor on top began to finger between my buttocks. "Ow," I said. "Ow, stop! Pauete!" That made the sailor holding my arms laugh, because it was both formal and plural, and it probably struck him as a funny time for me to be asking him formally to stop. The tall one let go one wrist and made as if to sock me in the face. He had immense hands. And when he did it, his knuckles looked like they were coming at me hard. I jerked my head aside, squeezed my eyes, and said, "Ah." But nothing connected. It was only a feint. Still, I hit my jaw on the bed's iron rim. When I opened my eyes, the tall one grinned and said, "Ha-ha." Then shook one finger in a slow warning. Still holding my wrist with one hand, he moved to the right, grabbed my leg just above the knee, and yanked it aside. The one on top got himself in then. Holding both my shoulders, he pushed, mumbling in Greek. The tall one moved back to take my free wrist again and squatted there, his face very close. He kind of smiled, curious. His breath smelled like sensen, or maybe chewing gum. He had very black hair, his white cap was still on, hazel eyes, and dark skin. By his knee, the other's cap had fallen on the rug. Cajolingly, he began to say, now in Greek, now in English, you like, suaresi, good boy, suaresi, you like. I grunted, I don't like, it hurts, you asshole. This pharmacologist, who'd first fucked me, told me that if I pushed out as if I was taking a shit, it wouldn't sting. But not this time. The one on me bit my shoulder, and panting came. The one kneeling glanced up at him, then sighed too, let go, stood, and grunted down at me as if to say, see, it wasn't that bad. The one behind me got off the bed and stood, pushing himself back into his uniform. Once he said to me in English, good, see, you like the tall one had. He picked up his cap from the floor and, he'd missed two buttons on his lap, pulled it carefully over his head, then pushed one side back up to get the right angle. I sucked my teeth at him and tried to look disgusted. Frankly, though, I was scared to death. In Greek, the squat one said, you want him now? I'll hold him for you. The tall one said, you jerk off, let's just get out of here. The squat one bent down again, picked up my jeans, and began to finger through my pockets. Then the tall one drew back his hand with the same feint he'd used on me. Come on, forget that, jerk-off. Let's get out of here, I told you. The squat one threw my jeans back down, and they went through the kitchen hanging. There was a back door, but I don't remember if I heard it or not. I lay on the bed a minute without moving, propped up on one elbow. Then I reached back between my buttocks. When I looked at my fingers, there were little pads of blood on two fingertips. I got up and went to the stall toilet in the corner. Urine puddled the stone floor. On Delisa's blue rug, it had darkened an area three times the size of someone's head. John must have sent one of them in to use the toilet while I was sleeping, before the first guy woke me. I reached inside, holding the jam with one hand, and got some paper from the almost empty roll. Still standing, I wiped myself, but with a blotting motion. It hurt too much to rub. When I looked at the yellow paper, there was a red smear, with some drops running from it, and slimy stuff on one side. My rectum stung like hell. I felt like I had to take a crap in the worst way. But the other thing the pharmacologist had said was to wait at least half an hour before you did that. When I went back to the bed, I saw the light in the kitchen had been turned out. As I sat down, gingerly, on the edge, on one cheek more than the other, from the dark behind the hanging, John asked, "Are you all right in there?" He sounded plaintive. For a moment I wondered if he was tied up or something. I called back, "I think so," then, "Yeah, I'm okay." A moment later, "Did they take anything from you?" I pulled my jeans back across the floor toward the bed with my foot. Then I looked at the bookshelf. Between fat volumes by Mann and Michener was a much-read Dell paperback of Vonnegut's Cat's Cradle, a quarto hardcover of Daisy Ashford's The Young Visitors, a chapbook of poems by Joyce Johnson, and Heidi's copy of L'Écume de Jour, which every few hours I'd taken out to struggle through another paragraph of Vian's playful French. No, I said. My wallet's safe. At the very end were the paperbacks of my own few novels, and the typewritten sheaf of my wife's poems sticking up between two of them. Wherever I stayed, I'd always put them on a shelf so I could see them, to make me feel better. They were the books I'd stuck my wallet behind. Good, John said. 20 seconds later, he said, I don't think they'll come back. And a few seconds on, good night. After a minute, I got up again, went to the kitchen door and switched off the little lamp. I didn't even look behind the hanging. The big light still out, you had to stand in the middle of the room to reach up and turn on. But John wasn't asking for help. So I went back and lay down. I tried to think of all the reasons I hadn't called for help. They might have beat me up or hurt me more than they had. What would neighbors or the police have thought coming in and finding me like that? Or thought of John? I might have gotten Delise in trouble with Costas, from whom she rented the house. Or I might have gotten Costas in trouble with the police. He was a nice guy, a Greek law student at Harvard, home for spring break, who probably wasn't supposed to be renting his house out to foreigners anyway. But lying there, I couldn't really be sure if any of those thoughts had been in my mind while it had been happening. Again, I pushed out like I was trying to shit. The stinging was just as painful. Then a muscle in back of my left thigh cramped sharply enough to make me cry out. A good number of people were on the platform when I got there. I had my guitar case and a shopping bag. At the bottom of the bag was Heidi's Vian. Then my underwear and my balled-up suit. On the top were my novels. Two had actually been published while I was here, though I had written them before. My wife had sent me a single copy of each as they came out. I'd figured to reread the newest one on the train, for more typographical mistakes, or for stylistic changes I might want to make, and maybe the typescript of her poems. It was as sunny as it had been on the Piraeus docks when I'd seen Heidi off to Aegina. Shabby-coated lottery vendors ambled about. Ticket streamers tentacled their sticks. A cart rolled by, selling milk pudding and spinach pie and warm orangata, big wheels grumbling and squeaking. Sailors and soldiers stood in groups talking together among the civilian passengers. When I saw him, the tall one, with four others in their whites, my heart thudded hard enough to hurt my throat, from the surprise. The back of my neck grew wet. I swallowed a few times and tried to get my breath back. But, no. I wasn't going to go up to the other end of the platform. I wasn't going to let the son of a bitch run me all around the train station. I took a deep breath, turned, and looked toward the empty tracks. But I hoped the train would hurry up. Not that he could do anything here with all these people. The third time I glanced at him, he was looking at me, smiling. He was smiling. Another surge of fear. But it wasn't as big as the terror at my initial recognition. Next time I caught him looking, I didn't turn away. So he raised his hand and waved, that little go-away gesture that in Greek means come over here. When I frowned, he broke from his group to lope toward me. He came up with a burst of Greek.
Kalimera sas. Tikanis. Kala.
Hello, you. How you doing? All right? Kalimera, I said, dry as a phrase book. But with his big, nervous, probably, but I didn't catch it then, smile, he rattled on. In front of me, the creaseless white of his uniform was as near blinding as a tombstone at noon. He towered over me by a head and a half. Now, with a scowl, he explained,
"Dethen ena philos, mu. Dethen eni kalos, topedi."
"He isn't a friend of mine. He's no good, that fellow. Where are you going? It's beautiful today, yes?
Orea simera, ne?
You are right. He's crazy, that guy. He just gets everybody in trouble. Me, I don't do things like that. I don't like him. I go out with him, I always get in trouble. Like with you and your friend up there that night. That wasn't any good. You're taking the train today? Where are you going? You're Negro, aren't you?
Mavros Essis?
You like it here in Greece? It's a beautiful country, isn't it? You had a good time? How long have you been here? I didn't want to tell him where I was going, so I mimed ignorance at half his questions, wondering just what part he thought he'd played in the night before last. I was surprised, though, I wasn't scared anymore. At all. Or really even that angry. Suddenly, for a demonic joke, I began to ask him lots of questions, fast. What was his name? Petros, ego, Peter, that's me. Where was he going? Sto Saloniki, to Thessalonica. Where was he from? Some little mountain town I'd never heard of before. Did he like the navy? With wavering hand, etsy getsy. So-so. He answered them all quite seriously, the grin gone and, I guess, a slightly bewildered look hanging above me in its place. Finally, though, he dropped a hand on my shoulder and bent to me. He'd come over to me, he explained, because he had something to show me. No, it's all right. Let me show it to you. Here. He went digging in his back pocket. For a moment I thought he was going to pull out his wallet to show me pictures. But when his hand came back around, he was holding a knife. No, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. I just want to show you something. I pulled back, but by the shoulder he forced me forward, still smiling. Here, he said. Here. Go on. You take it. Go ahead. Take it. Hold it. While he held the knife in his amazingly large hand, I saw the nails on his big fingers were clean, evenly clipped, and with ivory scimitars about the crowns, under clear polish. Like many Greek men, he wore his little nail half an inch or more long. I hadn't noticed any of that the night of Delisa's. I took the closed knife from him and thought, Greek sailors don't usually have manicures. Briefly, I wondered if he was queer himself. He said, Orea, eina, beautiful, isn't it? He didn't make any other gesture to touch it, but, with motions of two fingers together and the odd word, told me to open it up. It isn't very expensive, it's cheap, but it's a pretty knife, good, strong. You like it? It's nice, yes? Come on, open it up, a good knife. That button there, you push it up to open it. Yes, come on. I pushed the button up, and the blade jumped out. A sliver of light, of metal, of sky. Here, he laughed. It's a good knife, yes? I nodded, that is, moved my head to the side, the Greek gesture for yes. Ne, I said. Kalos to ene. Yes, it's a good one. He said in Greek, you want this knife, you like it, go on, take it, for you, you keep it. You like it, yes, I give it to you, for a present. Maybe you need it sometimes. It's a good knife. Yati, I asked, why are you giving this to me? You want to kill me now, he said with sideways nod, then added a chuckle. Cut something of mine off, I bet. I wouldn't blame you. No, I said. I shook my head. Or rather, raised it in negation. Ochi, I told him. You take it. I pressed the button. But it didn't close. He took it from me now. There was another pressure point you had to thumb to make the blade slip in. With his big manicured fingers, he thumbed it. Like that. The metal flicked into the silver and tortoiseshell handle. You sure? You don't want it? I said, Ochi. Evharisto, ochi. No, thank you, no. He put it in his back pocket again and regarded me a little strangely, blinking his green-gray eyes in the sun. Then he said, Fili, akomi, emish. We're friends now, us. Okay, I said in English. Just forget it. Esis, ego. Okay, he repeated. You... Me. Okay. You like. I like. With a flipped finger, he indicated him and me. Okay, friend. Me, you. He laughed once more, clapped me on the shoulder, then turned to go back to the others. As he walked away, knife and wallet square were outlined on one white buttock. I didn't feel like his friend at all. The other sailors were laughing again. I'm sure about something else. I watched them, wondering if I could see some effeminacy in any of their movements. Queer sailors camping it up on the station platform. Him, maybe. but not the others. Just once more he caught me looking and grinned again before the train came. When we pulled from the station, his group was still talking out on the platform, so he wasn't on my train. I was glad about that. That night, in my couchette, while we hurled between Switzerland and Italy, in the dark compartment I thought about the two sailors, and when my body told me what I was about to do, I had some troubled minutes, when it was too easy to imagine the armchair psychiatrists over their morning yogurt and rolls at the white metal tables in front of American Express explaining to me, in three languages, how, on some level, I had liked it, that somehow I must have wanted it. While I masturbated, I thought about the thick, rough hands of the squat one, but grown now to the size of the tall ones, and the tall one's hazel eyes and smile, but deprived of the sensen scent, and about sucking the squat one's cock with all its black hair, except that for the alcoholic sweat and cologne, I substituted the slight work salt of a good-humored house painter I'd had on the first day I'd got to Athens. Once I tried to use the knife blade, as he held it, full of sky. Nothing happened with it. At all. But I used my waking up, with the sailor beside me, his leg against my arm, his hand between my legs. I did it first with fear, then with a committed anger, determined to take something from them, to retrieve some pleasure from what otherwise had been just painful, just ugly. But if I hadn't, I realized once I'd finished, drifting in the rumbling and rocking train, then, alone with it, unable to talk of it, even with John or Heidi, I simply would have found it too bleak. I'd have been defeated by it, and more would have remained defeated. That had been the only way to re-seize my imagination, let go of the stinging fear, and use what I could of both to heal.
The Trade by Lars Einar from Best American Erotica 1996. Read by Stefan Rudnicki.
It's really too early in the day, Bruce thought. A fly buzzed around the dumpster at the corner. In the August heat, the dumpster stank. Bruce peeked around the corner. The Trade was still there, leaning against the wall near the entrance of the alley. He sure looks like Trade, Bruce thought. Bruce had walked past the man twice. I should make my move or forget it. Bruce walked slowly toward the man. Bruce slowed even more as he came near the man with the hard hat, the athletic T-shirt, the greasy jeans. The man was not going to speak first. Bruce was almost past him. "Got a light?" Bruce blurted out too suddenly. "In the alley," the man growled as he grabbed Bruce's arm. Bruce pulled back instinctively from such a violent move. It made no difference. The man was much stronger than Bruce. Bruce was dragged into the shadows far down the alley. "Look, how much?" Bruce asked. "I don't have much money at all." "You know how to suck dick?" Bruce didn't know what to say. "Hey, it's free. You don't have to pay me," the man explained. "But like, I'm straight. I don't do nothing back." Bruce nodded. The man's hand closed on the back of Bruce's neck. "Well, get to it. I got a dick that will change your life." The man's hand pushed Bruce to his knees. The man's button fly was just an inch in front of Bruce's face. Bruce unbuttoned the man's fly. When the man's cock was free of his jeans, Bruce scarcely had time to look at it before it was forced into his throat. It was big, rock hard, and shiny. "Not," thought Bruce, "so great that it's likely to change my life. Straight men are so vain about their dicks." But it was good, hard cock meat, and the man was hot and forceful without hurting Bruce. Bruce tried to get a hand free to open his own fly, but the man was already pressing Bruce against the wall. The man's powerful legs were driving the hard, hot cock into Bruce's mouth, fucking Bruce's mouth. Bruce could move only just enough to rub his dick through his jeans. Already the man was gasping and grunting. Bruce wanted to make it last, but he could not move. "Here's my nut, cocksucker," the man said between his teeth. Bruce's mouth was flooded with hot, sour cum. His own cock throbbed, and a sticky stain spread down the right leg of his jeans. Bruce swallowed. He swallowed again and began licking the man's cock tenderly. "That's it, cocksucker. You got it all." The man pulled his cock out of Bruce's mouth. "I don't do nothing back." "That's okay." Bruce was about to explain that he had come in his pants. "Don't matter whether it's okay. I don't do nothing back. I'm straight. Hey, cut it out. None of that love shit." Unconsciously, Bruce had laid his cheek against the greasy jeans on the man's thigh and had begun stroking the man's flank with his dry hand. None of the trade had ever objected to that before, at least not in the minute or two after they had come. The man stepped back out of Bruce's reach. He milked the large limp cock a couple of times, but there wasn't a drop left in it. "See you around, man. I gotta fly." And then the man was gone. Bruce sat on his heels for a long time, leaning against the wall. "I have got to stop doing trade," he thought. "That one could have killed me as well as anything." Bruce snapped back to reality when a fly landed on the huge cum spot on his jeans. The spot spread from halfway down his thigh almost to his knee. There was no way to cover it up. Bruce just had to hope that no one would notice before the stain dried in the August heat. He shooed the fly and stood up. Alan looked out the window. A September storm was brewing over the bay. There would be just enough time to get to the gym before it started to rain. Already it was dark enough so that Alan could see his reflection in the window. Alan forced a smile onto his face. "Bruce, come on. Let's go to the gym." Alan bounced into the living area wearing his chartreuse silk gym shorts, a blue and green soccer shirt, and his green Reeboks. "You go ahead. I don't feel like it." Alan looked at the TV that Bruce was watching. "You said that the last three times. It's not like you." "It's just so boring working out. And I hate the smell of the gym."
"I don't believe my ears. What's wrong, Bruce?"
"Nothing."
"Get out of the way. I can't see the TV." "Something is wrong. You say it's boring to go to the gym. You say you don't like the smell of the gym. You haven't worked out in 2 weeks. Come to think of it, you haven't made love to me in 3 weeks. And look, here you are watching commercial television. Is the cable out of order?"
"No. The cable's working fine. I just happen to like this show."
"You like watching The Wheel of Fortune?"
Alan reached to feel Bruce's forehead.
"Are you ill?"
Bruce realized that he had pulled back involuntarily to avoid Alan's touch. Bruce looked puzzled for a second. "No, I'm fine. I never felt better."
"Fine? The perennial hypochondriac? Bruce, you used to give someone a medical history if they asked how do you do. Now you tell me you're fine? You've never in your life said you were feeling fine."
"Well, now I feel fine, all right."
"Bruce, I think I better take you to see Dr. Jim."
"Hey, I don't need a doctor."
"Yes, yes, Bruce, I think you do."
"Okay, okay, if it will get you off my back. Jesus, I can't take this constant bitching. Now get out of the way. I can't see Vanna White."
"Yoo-hoo! Anybody home? It's Mona."
Mona peeked through the door at Bruce and Alan's tasteful living area. Mona coveted the Picasso sketches, although, as Alan always explained, they hadn't been so very expensive.
"Mona, come on back. I'm in the kitchen."
Mona entered the apartment. He found Alan rolling croissants on the marble slab. Mona sat at the bar.
"Mind if I have a drink?"
"Oh, no. Help yourself. Oh, let me get you some ice."
"Never mind. I don't need it."
Mona poured 4 ounces of rye into a highball glass and downed it, Alan noticed. That drink seemed a little excessive, even for Mona. Alan shooed a fly away from a buttery corner of the slab.
"Is something on your mind, honey?" Alan asked.
"Yes, well,
first let me ask you, how are things between you and Bruce?"
Mona poured himself another rye, but he seemed content to sip this one.
"Not so good, now that you ask." Why do you ask? Honey, darling, dear, I don't want to be the one to break it to you. I don't know how to soften the blow. I was downtown in high drag, you know.
Yes, go on. Alan put down the rolling pin and looked at Mona. Mona had not quite managed to get all of his eye makeup off.
You'll think I'm just flattering myself.
Out with it, Mona.
Your husband tried to pick me up.
Mona downed the rest of the drink and poured himself another one.
You don't seem to be especially surprised to hear that.
I'm not especially surprised to hear that. He hasn't touched me in weeks, and he's been doing all kinds of strange things.
Oh, my dear, I didn't mean that the way it sounded.
No, strange is right. I told you I was in high drag. The strange thing is he didn't recognize me. I almost think...
What?
Go on.
It sounds crazy. I almost think he thought I was an RG.
A real girl?
Exactly.
Alan, what does it mean?
I don't know, Mona. I thought he was ill. We're supposed to go back to Dr. Jim's this afternoon for the results of the tests.
Pour me one of those while you're at it. The front door slammed.
What in the hell is this shrieking? Bruce bellowed from the living area.
What shrieking? Alan called. This goddamn shrieking on the stereo.
The sound of a needle skating over a record came over the kitchen speakers, and in a moment from the living area, the little snap of vinyl bent past the breaking point.
Oh, God, Mona, Alan whispered. It was Don Giovanni, his very own record, his favorite.
They had been in the waiting room for a long time when Dr. Jim came to the waiting room. It was part of Dr. Jim's person-to-person style of medical practice that he came to the waiting room himself.
Bruce, Dr. Jim called, and Alan, you'd better come too.
Bruce and Alan followed Dr. Jim, not to an examining room, but to his office. Alan was surprised to see another man waiting for them.
Bruce and Alan, this is Professor Tom. I asked him to join us. There are some things I want him to explain to you himself.
A professor?
A professor of what? Alan asked.
Of a kind of biology, Professor Tom replied.
Alan looked suspiciously at Professor Tom.
What kind of biology?
Professor Tom is a virologist, said Dr. Jim.
A virologist? Then it is...
No, it is not any of the sexually transmitted diseases we tested for.
Dr. Jim tried to look reassuring, but it was the piercing blue-eyed encounter group stare that always put Alan's teeth on edge.
Professor Tom, why don't you take over?
Oh, yes. I need to know if the two of you have been completely monogamous. It's important.
Yes, said Alan immediately.
Well, practically, Bruce said slowly.
Practically?
Asked Alan.
I thought so. Professor Tom laid out a series of photographs on the desk. They looked like pictures of pairs of strange, banded, kinked-up snakes. In each picture, the pairs of snakes were numbered 1 through 22, and then there was a pair of mismatched snakes.
These are karyotypes. They show pictures of a person's genetic makeup. This one is from an old sample from Bruce. This is Alan's current sample. This is Bruce's current sample. And these are from a group of completely heterosexual men, each of them straight as a board. Now, see this little bump on the X chromosome of Bruce's current sample, and over here on the control group, we
skip the shit, Bruce said. Give us the bottom line.
You see, I've been working on this theory.
I said skip the shit.
I think you've caught a retrovirus of a kind we've never seen before. Your genetic makeup is being altered. It's a million to one shot, but it's being altered in a way that produces an extra kink on the X chromosome. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a clue as to what was happening. You see, I've been working on the theory.
I said the bottom line. What's happening to me?
You're developing an extra kink on your X chromosome. It looks very much like the same kink.
We hope we're wrong, said Dr. Jim. But think hard.
Did you do some trade? Say, maybe in the last 2 or 3 months.
Well, yeah, I guess I did.
Bruce remembered the man's words, "I got a dick that will change your life."
"We hope we're wrong," said Professor Tom, "but it looks like a kink I have found on the X chromosomes of only one type of man. See, the kink isn't on your old karyotype. And see, it's not on Alan's."
"Yes, go on."
"We found it only on the chromosomes of straight men, Kinsey zeros, so far. It doesn't necessarily mean anything. There could be lots of other explanations."
Alan thought about what Mona had told him.
"You mean..." "He means he thinks I'm going straight."
"What bullshit. That's what you mean, isn't it, Professor?"
"We think it's one possibility."
"Bullshit."
"Maybe so," Dr. Jim said. Professor Tom looked a little hurt.
"We are dealing with the unknown," Dr. Jim went on. "As scientists, we must not jump to conclusions. But we think it's definitely likely to be catching."
"Definitely likely? What does that mean?" asked Bruce.
"It means, until and unless we know more, only safe sex, okay?"
"Sure, sure," said Bruce.
Alan thought, "It's not the safe sex I mind. It's the no sex at all."
Bruce toyed with the thing on his plate. Finally, he brought the fork to his mouth. He got it past his lips. He forced himself to chew. He tried to swallow, but his throat began to close up. He felt like he was going to choke. He spit the chewed yellow mass back onto his plate.
"God, Alan, I can't eat this shit. Why can't we ever have steak and potatoes? Why does it always have to be this foo-foo stuff?"
Alan seemed frozen for a moment. Then the shuddering, icy finger of terror raced up his spine, snapping him back to reality.
"Bruce, you spit that out on your plate."
"So?"
"So your napkin is perfectly handy. But look, there it is on the table. You haven't even unfolded it in your lap. You just left it there under your silverware."
"So what? Even Miss Manners must have an occasional lapse."
"It's not just an occasional lapse, Bruce. Look at your hand. What's that in your hand?"
"My fork."
"Your salad fork, Bruce."
Alan was on the verge of tears.
"You tried to eat your quiche Lorraine with your salad fork."
"Hey, a fork's a fork."
"No, Bruce. You never used the wrong fork before. Don't you see? Can't you tell?"
"Tell what?"
"Like your fingernails."
Bruce dropped his fork on his plate and looked at the back of his hands. He saw. He tried to hide his hands in his lap.
"So?
My nails are a little dirty."
"No, Bruce, not a little dirty. Greasy. Your fingernails are greasy. Tell me, your car needed a tune-up. Does it still need a tune-up?"
"No."
"Bruce, where did you take your car for a tune-up?"
"I don't know. What difference does it make?"
"You know. You know what difference it makes. Why doesn't your car need a tune-up anymore?"
"Because I..."
"Yes, Bruce. Go on."
"Because I tuned it up myself, all right? That's what you wanted me to say. I said it. I'm just getting a little more butch as I get older."
"No, Bruce. Not just a little more butch. Like when you scratch your balls."
"What about when I scratch my balls?"
"When you scratch your balls, you don't put your fingers up to your nose and smell them afterward."
"So?"
"So, Bruce, every gay man in the world smells his fingers after he scratches his balls. Butch numbers do it most of all. You're not getting butcher. You're going..."
"Yes?"
"You're not getting butcher. You're going straight."
Bruce jumped up and overturned the dining table.
"No, no. You're just jealous. You're jealous because you're just a mincing little fairy who wishes she could pass for butch. Get out. Get out of my apartment."
Alan was appalled. The Picasso sketches were gone. In their place were three paintings on black velvet, one of Elvis, one of wild horses, one of a leering devil offering a cocktail glass, a pair of dice, and a curvaceous blonde. Alan could see only the back of the recliner. The recliner faced the television, which was tuned to a football game. On the mantel, in place of the Art Deco clock, was a tiny black-and-white TV,
tuned to a different football game. The room was littered with beer cans. A wave of dread passed over Alan. His voice cracked as he said, "Bruce? Bruce, are you here? I came as soon as I played back your message on the answering machine."
A deafening belch came from the recliner.
"Yes, Alan. Come in. I didn't want you to see me this way. Now I think you better. You were right. I am changing. I am changing into straight Bruce."
"Oh, no, Bruce."
"You were right. I've stopped denying it. Pull up the chaise lounge."
"You mean the chaise longue?"
"Straight Bruce calls it a chaise lounge. Just a second, the game's almost over."
Alan moved the rodent track and the hustler off the chaise longue and pulled it next to Bruce's recliner. Only after he was seated did he dare to look at Bruce. Bruce had changed. The stubble on his face had grown much past the fashionable 3 days' growth, yet it was not a beard. Bruce was wearing a stained and greasy white T-shirt. The beer belly was now very evident, completely obscuring Bruce's gym-built abs. Then there were the orange and blue plaid Bermuda shorts. Bruce lifted a leg and farted.
"Want a brew?" Bruce's hand plunged into the icy water in the Playmate cooler by his recliner.
"Do you have any white wine?" Alan asked, noticing on Bruce's forearm the fresh carbon tattoo of a dripping dagger.
"Nah. Not unless there's some you left here."
"Come on, goddamn, let's have that instant replay. God, did you see that call? It wasn't fucking interference. He was going for the ball. Come on, show the goddamn replay. Well, you want a beer or not?"
"You don't have any light?"
"Jesus, of course I don't have any light. Can't you see? You noticed it first. Can't you see what's happening to me?"
"Yes, Bruce. I can see. Bruce, how are you living? I mean, what are you doing for a living?"
"Oh, you know that after you moved out, they fired me from the salon."
"Yes, I know. What else could they do?"
"Nothing, I suppose. Well, they could have found something for me. Maintenance, janitor, something. It's okay. I found a job at an auto parts store. It's a great bunch of guys, only..."
"Only?"
"Well, it's only that you and I were buddies for so long."
"We weren't buddies. We were lovers. Lovers for 7 years."
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. "That's the game. Goddamn Wildcats. Goddamn. Dropped $100 on them last week, too. What was I saying?"
"We were lovers for 7 years.
"Oh, yeah. We were buddies for so long. Well, you know, in my situation, old pals are hard to come by. Look, I got some stag flicks at the video store. Let me put one in the machine."
Bruce staggered a little as he got up and went to the VCR. He pulled a tape from the stack and slipped it into the machine. Then he threw himself into the recliner. He picked up the remote control. After the FBI warning came the title, Sorority Snatch.
"This one's pretty hot," Bruce said as he began to squeeze the lump in his Bermuda shorts. The opening shot was exterior, at night. A man in dark clothes crawling into the bushes outside a building. Then, through the blinds, a well-lit room, college pennants on the wall, a teddy bear on the bed. A woman, possibly younger than 40, entered the room. She pulled a collegiate sweater off over her head. She bent, and reaching behind her back, began to unfasten her bra. Reverse angle of the man's eyes through the blinds, sweat forming on his brow and the muscle of his neck showing that somewhere below, out of view, his hand was moving frantically. Back to the woman. Alan had to look away from the screen. Bruce had unzipped his Bermuda shorts and was pulling at his long hooded cock. He noticed Alan looking at him.
"Hey, come on. Look at the flick."
"I can't stand it."
"Yeah, I know. Just don't be so obvious looking at my dick until I get going good. But, you know, we can still get off together, like this. I mean, I'm real drunk."
The sight of Bruce's cock getting hard overcame the repulsion Alan felt. Alan unzipped his own trousers slowly.
"Hey," Bruce said, "this wouldn't happen if I wasn't real drunk, but we've been buddies for a long time."
"Lovers, Bruce. We were lovers."
straight Bruce has to call it, buddies. Hey, don't stare. Look at